Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey, Diane, what's happening?
I know you know about this because I told you, but
right.
I think I'm going to let our listeners know about sort of a tragic turn of events. You may remember that last fall we spoke with Dr. Matthew Bradley, who was a professor at Utah State, a cancer survivor, and a paracyclist who was waiting to hear whether or not he would become a member of the U.S. team in Denmark. He did, in fact, go to Denmark and race with the U.S. paracycling team. Well, last Saturday, one of my yoga students, who actually lives in Utah most of the year and comes back because his family is here, came to class early. And after class, because we hadn't seen each other in a long time, walked on over to the bike shop and we started chatting. And he's telling me, or reminding me, of a story from last summer, I think, about a woman named Elizabeth Bunny Bradley. Her nickname was Bunny. How she had been hit and killed by a distracted driver. So she was hit from behind while she was riding. And I said, yeah, I remember that story. And he said, well, her brother-in-law, and he didn't use Matt's name. He called him something else. But he said her brother-in-law just passed away. And he started to relate the story about how the guy's a professor and that he's a cancer survivor. And I'm like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. And I think you all can hear where this is going. It turns out Matt was trying to take a soak in his hot tub, removed the prosthesis from his right leg, slipped, fell, hit his head, drowned, and nobody found him for 24 hours. So I was just, I said, this has to be the same guy, but it can't be the same guy. We just talked to him in September. So I ran over to the computer and I called up the interview and he said, call up the obituary. So we called up the obituary and sure enough, it is the same Dr. Matt Bradley. So if you have any time and didn't hear my interview with him, what a delightful guy. He was so loved. If you read this obituary, which I did post on Facebook, if you want to hear our interview, it was from last September 24th. And it's just heartbreaking. So Bob said, why don't you send me the link to the interview, which I did. I sent it to him, and he then sent it on to a member, either a member of the family or a friend of the family, and I got the most beautiful note back saying thank you. They would cherish it, and everybody in the family would listen to it.
Nice.
So, yeah, that was the good part, but oh, my goodness, it was
it is very sad and
it
very
is
tragic.
But very sad.
It's nice that we were able to capture a little bit of his essence in audio form. And that'll be preserved along with many good memories.
That's true.
Yeah.
Very true.
And, you know, I read the obituary and it in his interview, he didn't mention half of those things.
I know.
He was such an unassuming person.
I know.
You know, we talked about cycling. We talked a little bit how he was a college professor. But he had a whole rich, full life that was just reached a whole lot of people that we never even really heard about because he wasn't telling us.
No,
all
he wasn't.
That.
He was only 41 too.
Yeah.
He was young.
Yeah.
So that's that story. And so again, if you want to hear the interview, he was just so much fun. But yet, as Greg said, he didn't really tell us all the cool things he did, and he was just this brilliant guy, evidently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anywho, this week we talk with Jock Boyer. Now, writer Steve Friedman, who interviewed Jock for an article way back in 2009, had this to say about him. Like winning a Pulitzer Prize or discovering a distant comet, the distinction of being the first American to race the Tour de France might have furnished a first sentence for future obituary writers when they considered the life of this wiry, quiet vegetarian. His 32nd place finish paved the way for Greg LeMond, who became the first American to win the Tour in 1986, as well as the 7-Eleven team, which with sprinter Davis Finney and mountain climber Andy Hampston was the first American squad to successfully race in Europe, serving as a model and an inspiration for modern-day stars such as Lance Armstrong. Boyer was 26, and though he might not have known it, his fame was already receding. Jacques is now in his 50s. He spends most of his time in Rwanda, and he's the coach and trainer for Team Rwanda. He's in the U.S. for a couple of weeks, and we are lucky to be able to get a chance to talk with him this evening as he travels around promoting a new film about Team Rwanda. And it's going to be interesting. I hope to get to see it soon. Also on the show this evening is Reynold Yip. Cool name, huh?
Okay.
Okay, the unusual name is also part of his story, and one that begins in Hong Kong, follows his journey from engineering school to frame builder. Yip, whose Yipsan bicycles have won awards at NAVS, will tell us about his unusual name and his really lovely bikes. And lastly, we're just going to spend a few minutes with Joanna Varello from Media Productions. Joanna is producing the New Amsterdam Bike Show in New York City. It's the second year. She'll tell us about the show, which is coming up next weekend. So sit back. Welcome to the show, Jacques Boyer.
Thank you very much. It's a rare opportunity. I love talking about biking, and I like even more talking about the team.
Well, and you are in the U.S., and you don't usually spend much time here.
No, it's rare, and by some chance, it's during the Sea Otter. Right now, as we speak, I'm at Craig Calfee's place on the Monterey Bay Academy property right by the ocean. It's an incredible day. Craig's got some African endeavors on the bamboo bike. We've got our team. He's come and visited us. He helps us out. It's been great. I mean, we've got some amazing industry partners, and it's really fun to be partnered with some of these guys.
Well, it's interesting. That's right. I didn't even put it together that you're here at the same time as Sea Otter, and then there's the Bicycle Leadership Conference that's going on. All kinds of stuff are going on right now.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it was just kind of by fluke we're back this time of year. We didn't plan it this way, but it just happened.
Well, let's back into a little bit about who you are and where you came from, because you are really what started Americans racing in Europe. You were the man. Modern-day bike racing, as we know it, started with you. So tell me about your ambition to go to Europe and how you got into all of this cycling stuff.
I started riding my bike when I was 14, and 2 weeks after graduating from high school when I was 17, I went to Europe, just wanted to race. I'd found a team in the middle of France, and that's how it all started.
Wait, you just decided to go to Europe and find a team?
I had a friend, an Italian friend, Remo Dagliano, who just recently died, who had raced in France when he was a kid and contacted his old team, and that's the first team I went to in the middle of France in a really remote area. He had said, we got a good junior rider, he's coming, and basically that's what happened. I just showed up at their club ride.
What were you riding in those days?
I had also, he had a friend that had a bike building company, La Gazelle, in Paris. I first stopped in Paris, got a bike from him, took a train to the middle of France, and showed up. It was called the La Gazelle with campy equipment on it.
That is very cool. You were a gutsy kid.
I know. When I look at 17-year-olds now and I say, wow, did I go to Europe at that age? It's just like, oh my.
Really?
I don't know how I did it. I really don't. That is pretty young. And I ended up spending 10 years there and didn't go home that much.
So you started with this small team. Did you go to other teams then while you were there?
After I started winning races with this little team, one of the bigger teams in Paris saw me race and said, hey, come to our team, which I did. That was the ACBB out of Paris. And I spent 3 years in the ACBB as a amateur, and then the next year turned pro with Lejeune. And at that point, the top rider in Lejeune was Lucien Van Imp, who had won the Tour de France, and also Roy Scuyten, who is a world pursuit champion. And then we had an amateur world champion, Andre Hevers.
So put that in context time-wise. What year was that, would you say, or in what years?
I went to France in 1973.
Wow.
I turned professional in 77. and then my first pro team was a French team, and I stayed on a French team until the end of my career. I did 1 year in an Italian team, and then I finished my career with 7-Eleven team. My last year as a pro, 87.
That's cool. So then when did you come back to the States? Because you also did Ram, and more than once.
Well, when I was, my first Ram was 1985.
Right.
And I was still racing with 7-Eleven. Jim Aquitz at that point, he said, yeah, you can race the Ram. And I did, and then I came back and raced with the team for another couple of years.
Yeah, yeah, but you didn't just race Ram. You won Ram.
Well, yes. Actually, that's all. I did Ram over a bet. And it was the year before I was with David Michaels and his brother the day after Thanksgiving in Palo Alto. We were at Al Michaels' house, and we were talking about the Ram, how, you know, they were, you know, saying they were really good riders. And I said, man, you know, I could beat those guys. They're, you know, they're endurance athletes. They're not racers. And he said, well, you owe it to the cycling community. If you could beat them, you have to ride Ram. So I said, okay, I'll do it next year. And that's why I went out and did Ram.
You are funny. You are really funny. So then 20 years later, you did Ram again.
Yes, I did it in 2006 when I was 50. And that again, the year prior to that, Eric Heiden and Max Testa called me and said, well, we're working with UC Davis, and we're with the transplant team, and we want to do an 8-man Race Across America team to raise funding and awareness for organ transplants. Can you be our crew chief? And I said, sure, I'll be a crew chief. So I was a crew chief for the first Team Donate Life team, which we came in second. You know, and all the guys riding the team, they were either doctors or transplant recipients.
Cool.
So it was just so much fun. And Eric wrote it. Max helped. He was our doctor. And we had anesthesiologists. We had liver transplant guys. We had kidney recipients. I mean, it was just great. And when I saw it and I did it, I said, man, I could come back and do this race. So I asked Team Donate Life if they wanted to do it as a, you know, solo event. And they said, absolutely. So they got behind me. I did it for Team Donate Life. And then they also did a 4-man team and I think an 8-man team also that year. So I did it as a 50-year-old in the Enduro, and I won it as a 50-year-old.
So I'd like to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jack Boyer. He is visiting the United States from Rwanda. And we're going to talk about Team Rwanda right now. So how did you come to move to, basically, you live in Rwanda now, or in Africa?
I do live in Rwanda. In 2006, Tom Ritchie contacted me and said, well, I'm going back. He had been to Rwanda once. I didn't want to go on that trip. He said, I'm going to organize a bike race. He wanted help with that. You know, can you come over? I agreed. I went over in the fall of 2006, and we saw some really good talent. We said, hey, you know, along with another friend, Dan Cooper, we said, let's do a bike team. And he already, in his mind, was thinking about how to get some of these riders that looked talented a chance in racing. So I kind of didn't really want to go over there, but reluctantly said, okay, I'll go over and bring my CompuTrainer over there for testing, and I'll stay a couple months and see if they've got any good numbers. And that's what I did at the beginning of 2007 and have been there ever since. We kept getting funding for like 3 months or 4 months, so I said, well, when the funding ends, I'll come home. And up until now, we still have about a buffer of about 3-4 months to keep going. So we're still going.
So do you like living in Rwanda?
Living in Rwanda is very difficult, but it's very rewarding. It's not necessarily easy to live there.
Okay.
I come from Carmel, California, by the ocean, so it's a far cry from that. But the project, working with the riders, is really, really good, and that's what keeps me there. We have a lot of amazing stories that come out of being with the team, and that keeps me going. You know, the fact that the electricity goes out 5-6 times a day, and, you know, water goes out, things break all the time. We're lucky to get internet all the time. It's still at 128K, so we can't download really anything, you know. But we get a lot done. We've got a really good small team. I've got one French mechanic and Kimberly Coates, who does all our PR and marketing, and myself, and that's pretty much the team. We have a really good cycling federation, and I think out the cycling federation being so engaged in what we're doing, we couldn't have stayed there.
So
it's a lot easier.
So I saw a really good video. I think it was about 9 minutes long of a young rider named, is it Rafiki?
Rafiki or Adrian?
I think I saw Rafiki, and so, Kimberly was in it too, because
okay,
she
was the CNN piece. Yeah.
Yes, the CNN piece. So his story just broke my heart, and yet there he is, just pedaling away on the trainer. So I can see why being in Africa is so fulfilling from that perspective. Tell us about these riders, how you're finding them, and how they're training, and how they live with all this horror that was their life.
Yeah. To answer your last question first, how they live with their past and all the trauma and all the difficulties they face, even on a daily basis, I have no idea how they do it. I mean, it's phenomenal, and it's inspiring. These riders, when we get them, you know, they live on dirt floors. Very few of them have electricity now. Maybe 5 or 6 of them have electricity. None of them have running water. They go on 3-4 hour rides, and when they get home, they sponge bath with dirty river water and get up and do it every day. We do training camps every week from Monday to Friday. That's when they get their showers. That's when they get good food. That's when they get their English lessons, hygiene lessons, nutritional lessons. You know, they see videos of the tour, and you go to their homes. I mean, it's a reality check. We have no idea how good we have it in America. We have so much, and they don't complain. I mean, I go to races, and they are the ideal team for non-complaining. Because nobody ever complains, because no matter how bad it is, it's better than what it is at home. And it's some of the guys, Rafiki, you know, was a street kid. During the genocide, he lost his parents. He had to flee, and they all fled sometimes in different directions. And we have a couple orphans on the team, you know, lost their family early on and just kind of survived as orphans in a country that was just in total havoc and chaos for so many years. Most of our riders have lost family members, or I would say all of them have lost family members in the genocide. Adrian, who has qualified this year for the London Olympics, he lost 6 brothers and 60 family members in the genocide. And he survived with his grandmother hiding in the woods, and when it was over, had to come back home and bury everybody with his remaining family. The resilience the guys have are pretty phenomenal, and they're talented. And taking that talent and putting it into a bicycle and teaching them how to ride races and shift gears, it's challenging and it's slow at times, but it's really getting to be where we have a really good team. We're right now, I think, 6th in the continent from coming from 0 5 years ago. So the team is successful. The team is not just about cycling. It's just about changing lives through the bicycle, which is, you know, very much fun for me.
Well, and that's what Craig is looking at too. Craig Calfee, you know, he just approaches it from another perspective. Tell me about Adrian. So what event is he going to be entering in the Olympics this summer?
Adrian is going to be in the mountain biking cross-country event.
Cool.
He's more an endurance rider, so the cross-country event is a little bit short, but he did qualify. He missed the road spot just by one place, unfortunately, but he is on the mountain bike team, and he races for MTN Quebeca in South Africa. So he lives in South Africa. He's getting really good training. His coach is really good. He's got a good European circuit pre-Olympic training. He's on Trek bikes this year, so he's being integrated in the Trek Pro team when he goes to Europe and races the World Cup races. So he's got a chance. It's already changed his life, and it's already made him an amazing person, an amazing example for the other riders in Rwanda. Now the young kids see him and say, wow, I can do it too. So because of Adrian and because of stars like him and because of the team members, we're getting a whole different support, not just from the government, but also from all the people. And they're the ones that we're going to be testing soon, and they're the ones that are going to be the future champions in Rwanda.
Wow. So you also, wow, it's a mind-blowing story, actually. So you're also in the U.S. right now promoting a film. What's the film about?
When we started the project, the Team Rwanda, they wanted, our Dan Cooper, one of our board members, absolutely wanted to do a film starting from then. So he got funding for a film, and a film crew has followed us over the last 6 years. And they finished the film. We had, we are doing right now a couple private viewings, and the film's called Rising from Ashes. We've had amazing support. John and Linda Halbert out of Texas actually helped us finish the film, and are the producers of the film, or directors, I think. And it's about the team and how it's changed the nation. And it's very emotionally charged film. You see the riders from the very beginning, from where they came from. You see the country from where it came from, and you also see where it is now and where Adrian is now and how much it has not just transformed one life, but the whole ground level from the country. I mean, it's changed the country and is continuing to change a country. And it's a remarkable story. And to have it on film as a documentary is pretty amazing.
So, Jacques, how has all this Team Rwanda stuff changed you?
It has changed me completely. It's really put my focus in something that is most fulfilling. It's really difficult, but it's the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. Reaching out and actually being able to help people and seeing what it does real time is amazing. It's something, when you do it, you can't really turn back. You see how much we have and how much we can be used for a purpose in other people and helping other people. And that's really, really an amazing thing to do. And it's very fulfilling.
Wow. I think our listeners would be interested in a couple of things. One, obviously, is how they can help support Team Rwanda. And so you can tell us about what people who might be interested in your program can do. And the other is how the film is going to be distributed and when people will be able to see it. So you can pick either one of those to go first and tell us both.
Okay. We do have a website. It's called teamrwandacycling.org. And on the website, there's a multitude of ways of helping out. We do dental care, just for example, for the riders. If you want to sponsor a root canal, it may seem horrific, but it really helps.
Yeah, I'll bet.
We do full dental care for all the guys that come through the camp. And we've got a great dentist. It's actually really, really cheap compared to America. If you want to sponsor a training camp, if you want to sponsor a rider going to the UCI World Cycling Center or the South African Cycling Center, there's, you know, all different things. It's pretty well spelled out in the website. Little donations are really huge. I mean, little things go a long way for us. We're very lean. There's only three people, really, that's running the whole thing. And that's the best way of donating, and it's much appreciated. We also have gear that you can buy that, you know, are, well, all the profits of the gear definitely go to the team. And the movie Rising from Ashes, we're looking at possibly being at the L.A. Film Festival. I'm not sure it's accepted yet. Forrest Whitaker is our narrator, so he's helping our distribution. And I would say it's going to be out right before the Olympics or right after the Olympics. I'm hoping right before, or at least it's debuting before the Olympics. Okay. And that's about it.
Wow, that's a lot. A whole lot. Well, this turned out to be, just like I thought, a great conversation, and I really enjoyed it, and I know that you'll say hello to Mr. Calfee for me.
I certainly will.
And say hello to Kim and tell her thanks for helping set all this up. I really appreciate you taking time, and I hope that Adrian does really, really well. We'll be watching the Olympics, and enjoy Africa. I don't know if I'll ever get there, but it sounds like a really interesting place to be.
Thank you very much. All right. And I appreciate all the support, even just in prayers and just thoughts. So God bless you guys, and thank you for calling.
It is my pleasure. Have a great night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jock Boyer joined us from La Selva Beach, California, where he's bunking with Craig Calfee in the gang.
Yeah, it's a nice place to bunk.
I'm sure it is.
It's a great place.
Yeah. Boy, he has done some amazing things, and he's still doing amazing things.
There's something called the Wooden Bike Program out in Africa, too, that I did see, and we didn't really talk about that. I mean, I wanted to get as much in as we could, and as it was, I think we skipped over a lot of things.
On a lot of interesting stuff.
We did. You know, Africa's tough, and especially Rwanda, when you think about how horrific life was in Rwanda.
Yes, what they have been through, sure.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Well,
great
guy.
We
shouldn't complain, but we still do here in the States, you know?
I think that's human nature.
Probably true.
Yeah.
Probably true. Well, I won't complain that we get to take a short break.
Okay.
But we'll come back. We've got two more great guests for the second half of the show.
All right.
So stick around on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Saturday, April 28th, Medwish International hosts its Band Aid Bash 2012, a party for the planet. All proceeds from this event will benefit Medwish International's mission to recover those usable surplus medical supplies and equipment designated for disposal by hospitals, and instead redistribute them to developing nations where they can save and improve lives, helping both people and our planet. More information at medwish.org.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we didn't get to do this last week, so I want to take just a second now to welcome Columbus, Ohio.
WCRS in Columbus, Ohio is on board. Our newest Outspoken Cyclist Station.
That's a little low-power FM down there in the Columbus, Franklin County area.
Community-oriented.
That's right. That's a good word for it.
Yeah.
And they're airing The Outspoken Cyclist, I think, at 3 p.m. on Friday afternoons.
We are the opening of the station because they're on from 3 p.m. to 3 a.m.
That's right.
And we are the very first show Fridays. So welcome aboard, and we're very happy to have the Columbus market.
Hi, Columbus.
Hi, Columbus. Hi, Jody.
We'll see you in May if we're riding Tazru. Okay, moving along then.
Moving right along. So our next guest is a frame builder. Lo and behold.
Who'd have believed? Could knock me over with a feather.
Yeah, but I think he's very interesting. His name is Reynold Yip, and the name of his company is Yipsan Cycles. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. When we met at NABS this year out in Sacramento, I really liked the bike you built for your wife, Lee. It was on display. That bike won an award, and you've won other awards at NABS, yes?
That bike did not win an award, but it's actually, that's a small story to that. I had a bike that is very much like that, which won two awards back in 2010. And the one I built for my wife is kind of a sequel because the first one was already a customer's. And I have always had people who live in my town ask about, oh, where can we see that bike? But I don't have one. So I've been wanting to build one for my wife that is in that style and also incorporate some sort of further improvements. And I got to do that the past year. And actually, I also took that to the Oregon Manifest, where my wife actually rode the bike during their field tests. And so it was a great experience, and I get to build that bike again with many new features on it. It was great, yeah.
What was different about the one I saw than the one that won the... because I love the bike. That's what made me stop go to the booth. It was so cool looking.
Thank you. Well, other than the color, which is obvious, the last one was very attractive in a sunflower yellow. This one, I actually picked the color more based on the city I grew up in. We had a city flower, and it was a bohemia, and I picked the color based on that being purple and white. But anyway, the extra features as compared to the other one was mainly I put a steering lock on the front. I don't know if you ever had experience with a bike when you have it parked and you're loading things and the front end turn around the steering, and then it flopped the whole bike, and sometimes the whole bike would fall down, sometimes it causes other trouble. So I put a steering lock on it, so when you have the bike parked and you're loading, be it the front or the back, it's very, very stable. And I find that being, it's a small thing, but it's very important for daily use of a bike like that. And then another feature is a lock that is incorporated onto the bike, so you basically... you will not leave home without bringing a lock. I personally had many times go to town to just do something, thinking I won't stop anywhere and lock up the bike, but end up I had to lock it and want to lock it somewhere and go into a store or something, and I just never had a lock with me. So this feature, I think, again, being a city bike, is a very important thing to just have it there ready for use without having to think about it ahead of time. And the last thing is actually just a chain guard to keep your pants away from the chain and that, yeah.
Well, I really like the double down tubes and the shape of them, that they make that bend as opposed to going straight off the head tube and all the way back to the rear wheel, in a straight line. I really thought it was a very nice looking bike.
Yeah, and that in fact is the main thing for a city bike too. I mean, if you have your bike load, with weight front and back, and some people are not as flexible and to straddle the bike. Having that low top tube, or some people call it the mixed design, is just so much easier to put your foot over the bike, and then you can start pedaling.
So let's back up a little bit, because I think you have such an interesting background. Tell people where you grew up and what your educational background is.
Right. I grew up in Hong Kong, China, during the 70s and the 80s, when it was actually still a British colony. And my dad was an avid motorcyclist. He actually named me after a brand of motorcycle chain, Renault. And at that time, that chain was very popular and was used on Triumphs and Nortons and all those British motorbikes. And he's also the person who showed me the basics of the mechanics of a bike. And so I start from maybe, say, 7 or 8. I understand how to take apart a BB and to adjust bearings and basic things like that. That's how I kind of got into bicycle at a young age. And I went to UK for university, and I got an engineering degree from there. And after that, I went back home to work as an engineer. And in 2002, I followed my wife to come to the U.S., and that's actually when I made a big change from sort of engineering-type work to bicycle-related work.
When did you decide to start building bikes?
I've wanted to build bikes at very young age. Like I said, my dad taught me bicycle stuff. He also told me how a lug frame is put together. You know, being it's not just two tubes butting against each other, but having that extra piece that the tubes slip in, and you know, there's an extra process to put it together. I find that very interesting. Although I didn't do anything about that until 2005 when I went to UBI and learned the bike frame building. And at that time, the main reason is kind of, I've always wanted to do it, but I've never done anything to it. But so it's more just to satisfy my own curiosity and my own wanting at a young age. But after that, I just kept doing it, trying to improve. I mean, each one does get better, even until now, after, you know, 7 years, each one does get better. So there's always things to improve. There's always things to approach from a different direction. So it's very interesting.
You mention quite a bit on your website about bike fitting. Where did you learn about bike fitting?
I learned bike fitting basically from about 2004 when I started working in a bike shop in the sort of outskirts of Greater DC. I was living there at that time. Main thing was the shop. Actually, we did a lot of fitting. There's a lot of local racers and triathletes who go to that shop and buy bikes and get fitting done. So being a small shop, where I work at the bench, I can actually see the feedback. And so just observations and then later maybe asking questions. I learned a lot from there. And then 2006, the shop actually sent me to Sir Roger Fit School. That's actually how I sort of complete the not just the observation, but the actual learning. And then after that, I've been doing fitting on all the shops that I've worked with. And, of course, now for my customers, especially for those who actually can come to visit or we can find a mutual place, we can sort of sit together for a couple of hours to go into that. Because it does require time and sort of patience. I'm sure you know about that, too. It is something very important in my view for a good custom bike. It's basically the starting point, because again, if a bike doesn't fit well, however cool it looks, however nice it's equipped with components, it's not going to be a nice bike for the customer.
I would totally agree with that. I have a question about the kinds of bikes you normally build. Now, so I saw this beautiful city bike. Is that mainly what you build, or do you build all types of bikes? I know and do you only work in steel? I really probably should preface it with that.
Right. I do only work with steel. And some people would ask, what joining method? And I usually build lugged and fillet braced. I build all types. I do love building city-type bikes because I think those bikes, in a way, for a customer to decide to buy a city bike, they get used a lot. They do get real meaningful miles, not just for exercising, but actually, you know, sort of replacing their vehicle in a certain sense. So I really like doing that. However, I must also say, city bikes, by the time we have it done, the cost of it versus a lot of people, how they view a city bike, most people would think is quite expensive. So in general, I don't get a whole lot of orders for pure city bikes, but I do enjoy doing it. But at the same time, city bike actually, the approach being is usually equipped with fenders, lighting, a more comfortable riding position, low carrying capacity. So it's also related to random mirroring style bike, and I do quite a lot of that. I also do some mountain bike, and I love doing those. So it's all types, but at the same time, I probably there's a higher percentage for bikes that are equipped with fender, wider tires. Sort of you can go anywhere. You can carry a few extra things than just the saddlebag. I love doing those because it does challenge me more. The placement of the fender bridges are a lot more demanding than typical road racing sport type bike, and lighting system require me to think further, as in where to put holes so that the wires can be hidden and things like that. So it does require more forethought The actual building may not require more work, but it's just more design, more planning ahead of time.
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Reynold Yip at Yipsen Cycles in Fort Collins, Colorado. So that brings me to a question that I had about whether you think being an engineer is a necessity to be a frame builder.
Okay. I don't think it's necessary, and of course you can see in the field right now there are a lot of people who do not have that background. So I do think it helps in sort of identifying problem and solving problems. And of course, in the field today, there are really a lot of good builders. And how do you maintain your own quality level is another thing. So how do you keep a process that is consistent so that you know what comes out at the end when you turn off the torch? So I think those things are in a way more important, and my sort of background would help me sort of see it, hopefully in a more analytical and clear manner.
That was an excellent answer. I enjoyed that. Thank you very much. Do you do your own painting?
No, I don't. I subcontract. It's just a skill set that is totally different. So I would, one day I would like to learn that, but I think at this time I should focus more on the metalwork and leave the painting to a professional painter. But I do enjoy sort of participating in, what color combined, what color would look cool. I think that is always the first thing the customer will see and the customer's buddy will see. So it's good to make it look good. But again, the first thing has to be, it's got to fit right. It's got to be designed for the right application. So if they're going to ride dirt road, or if they're only going to ride paved roads, so there will be differences in the design of the bike.
So you also have some interesting symbols and words on your bike. Can you sort of describe that? I think they were very cool. I noticed them right away.
Thank you. As you know, handmade bike is very personal, so I feel that every bike that I make is, there is a part of me in it. And I hope, of course, during the process with the customer, there's a lot of interaction. So a lot of times we become, friends. So I feel that I want to share part of my ethnic origin on all the bikes that I build. And I try to put a few sort of Chinese touches onto the finishing. The main two things that I think most of my bikes have right now would be the head badge, which is a stylized version of my last name in simplified Chinese. So I think most, especially mainland Chinese, would be able to see it quite easily. But actually myself, being a Hong Kong Chinese, just like Taiwanese, we actually usually write in the traditional form, which is more complicated. So, and if I were to put that onto my head, that would be just somewhat too complicated. And the second one that I really liked is actually sort of a square-shaped decal.
Right.
And that one is actually similar to sort of a stamping by an ancient king as a seal of approval. And inside it just says a handmade steel. But I thought it's kind of an interesting way. And a lot of Chinese, when we were growing up, your parents would get us sort of a little stamp that has our name on it as a kind of a way to sort of put a signature on something. So it's always remind me of sort of old school Chinese tradition that we generally do not see today.
What do you think has changed for your business since you won the awards at NABS in 2010, right? Yeah. And what do you think is going to keep changing for you? Do you see things changing for you?
Your first question, definitely it helped to have won an award, to have sort of caught some attention. But I must say also at that time, I wasn't quite as defined. In fact, that year, 2010, I showed 5 bikes. They are all different category, as in mountain bike, straight up sport road bike, a city bike, a randonneur bike. So it was kind of all over the place. Of course, that makes me caught most of the attention. I think now I am somewhat more defined in a niche. although I still build some mountain bike here and there, as number is way less than a road bike with wide tires. But as in the last few years, I think that's exactly the trend. I've been building more bikes with fenders, with wide tires, that people want to be able to still go fast, but at the same time to be able to ride roads that are less optimal and maybe even ride dirt roads. And myself, even I don't do actual randonneuring, real long distance rides, but I do ride on dirt roads, and I do sort of purposely try to hook up roads that have both pave and dirt, and of course sometimes riding at night to benefit from the integral lighting. It's just a very pleasant type of bike to use because it's always ready. And one other thing also, I think I've been seeing a slight trend, and I'm sure people are picking up on that, is these type of bike, when you incorporate these brakes to it, it makes it even better. It's truly more sort of all condition. If it's raining, if there's moisture, you're not going to have to worry about braking. If you are descending a long mountain descent, you don't have to worry about sort of burning off your rims. So I think that's also one thing that would probably happen more.
Are you going to be at NABS in 2013? Oh, of course you are. It's in Denver.
It's a good question, because actually when this year when I met you in Sacramento, all the while during the show, I've been thinking, okay, I need to take a break. It's very costly. It's very tiring, to be honest, especially in my case. It's really just my work, but I have to have my wife come along to support me both, you know, physically and mentally, I guess. So every year our holiday is almost partly just burnt wherever we have to be at NAPS. I feel so unfair for her because however she likes cycling, she is not quite like us who's sort of soaked in every day in cycling. So I feel kind of unfair for her. And so I thought, you know what, I'll take a break for 2013. But now
right.
It's coming to Denver. I have no excuse. It's only 1 hour away from where I live. So I will be there, yes.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you telling me about your company, about your background, and about your bikes. I learned a little bit at the show. I learned a lot more now. I like your approach very much. Obviously, you really think things out very well, and I can appreciate that. I hope to see you in Denver. I plan on being
Thank
there.
Thank you.
And why don't you let our listeners know what your website is so that they can go out and learn about your bikes?
Thank you. My website is www.yipsanbicycles.com, so YIPSAN, and then bicycles.com.
Okay, then. Well, we'll also put a link up on our radio station page. And again, thanks so much.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Have a good evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Reynold Yip joined us from Fort Collins, Colorado, where he and Lee are the proprietors of Yipsan Cycles.
Yes, they are.
Some beautiful machines.
I know.
And some innovative frame element designs, you know?
I like the way he thinks.
That double down tube, and he's got the brake cable housings routed inside the down tubes.
Oh, Mr. Detail. I know. You peruse those things while we're talking
I
here.
Do. I
know.
I like to check things out. I love pictures.
I know
Especially
you
Especially pictures of bikes. You
Pretty
know?
Bikes.
Bike porn.
Bike porn. Yeah, and that's but his. I'll tell you what. One of the very first booths I stopped at NABS was his because mm-hmm. that bike stopped me in my tracks. I looked at it and I went, whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice stuff.
Yeah.
We are just, making the final turn here, but we've got one more guest. We go to the other coast.
We do. We go to New York City, where we welcome Joanna Varello from the New Amsterdam Bike Show. Hi, Joanna. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thanks for having me, Diane.
Tell us a little bit about the show.
The New Amsterdam Bike Show is a an event that we created about a year ago. This year will be our second one. And what it is like, imagine the world's biggest and coolest bike store with a beer garden and seminars.
So where is the show being held?
The show is being held in Soho at a very luxurious venue called Soho Skylight. It's at 275 Hudson Street in New York City.
Nice. Nice. Mm-hmm. Last year was your first year with the show. Is this a different venue this year?
It is. And last year was the first year of the show. So this year is the second year, and we switched venues because we wanted to go back to the original venue, but it had different floors, and this is all one level, which makes it easier for people to peruse the bikes.
So how many exhibitors will you actually have?
Close to 70.
Wow, that's a nice number. How many are actually bike shops?
Well, let's see. My good friend Julie Hirschfeld, she is going to be there with her bike shop called Adeline Adeline.
And I know Bicycle Habitat will be there, my friend Charlie McCorkle's shop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He'll be there with Laura, his marketing manager, who's Dream. And let's see, we have Bicycle Works NYC, which is downtown Lower East Side. We have Rolling Orange, which is in Brooklyn, which just mainly deals with Dutch bikes.
Right.
And let's see, what's Echelon Bicycles, which is high-performance bicycles.
Wow.
And a couple other.
That's terrific. So you also call it not just a consumer show, you call it a lifestyle show. So can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Well, I think that idea was given to me by Paul Steely White about a year and a half ago when he said, don't make it just a bike show, make it more of a lifestyle show. And I asked him, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, get stuff like by companies like Moleskine that protect your computer when you're riding your laptop and all that stuff, like Levi's commuter jeans and the right shoes, like things that you could use to ride your bike, but you can also use in normal day life.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Do you have any cool celebrities coming? Is our buddy Eben Weiss going to stop by, Mr. Bike Snob?
Yes, he is. He's going to do a bra. It's what he calls a book-related appearance.
Yeah, of course it is. That's right. He's got a new book that's out.
That'll be at 4 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, and we expect a visit from our good friend, Mr. Matthew Modine, who was in our fashion show last year.
Good.
And we have Grant Peterson, who is a principal over at Rivendell Bicycles.
You got him to come out of his hole in the ground and come to New York?
Yeah.
Congratulations. He's good job, Joanna.
Well, I had some help with that through Caroline Sampanaro at the TA, so I can't take all the credit. But he's coming to read from his book, Just Ride.
That's awesome. Where can people get tickets for the show? And tell us about exactly what days and what times the show is going to be happening.
The easiest way to get tickets is to go online and go to www.newamsterdambikeshow.com. And up at the top, there'll be a tab for tickets, or you'll see an orange ticket right on the sidebar. You can click on that.
Okay.
And then you can go to the ticket page and purchase as many tickets as you want. And then the ticket is an e-ticket because we didn't want to give out hard tickets.
Yeah, so, right.
You just bring the e-ticket to the show and we let you in. The show is on April 28th, which is Saturday, and April 29th, which is Sunday. Both days, the show runs from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Wow, it's a long day for the exhibitors, huh?
Long day for me.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Well. Yeah. You don't count. You decided to do this. So.
Yeah.
That's. So, what do you think makes the New Amsterdam Bike Show different from some of the other bike shows that are around? I know that Philly does their bike expo. You know, the Belinkies do theirs in Philadelphia.
Yeah. You know. When I read this question, I thought about it last night, and I have to say that, you know, I went to art school here in New York City, and one of my teachers said, you know, the secret to being a good illustrator is to not look at other illustrators.
That's an interesting point.
Well, I made the mistake of looking at other illustrators, and I think I was influenced. So, you know, last year was my first time doing this, and I just did not go to another bike show. I just imagined what an amazing bike show would be like, and I just built it.
So what made you decide to produce a bike show? How are you involved in bicycling yourself?
Basically, I grew up in Connecticut, and my uncle had a bike shop, and I spent a lot of time in it. And it wasn't the fanciest of bike shops, but I learned to take apart a bike, put a bike back together. I learned about customizing bikes and building my own bikes. So I'm in love with bikes. All my life, I've been in love with bikes. I like to rescue bikes. I like to ride bikes, you know, et cetera. I'm a bike geek. But the second part to your question is, I started working for Manhattan Media, which is where I work now, and they were looking to start some events that were on a larger scale that would fit in with the demographic here in New York. And, you know, the way my brain works is I looked around and I noticed everyone's on a bicycle. Why isn't there a bicycle show, or why hasn't there been one in the last 6 years? So I pitched the plan, and we started a bike show.
That's very cool. How many people came to the show last year?
In one day, we had a little bit over 3,000 attendees.
Oh, well, you know, it is New York City after all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I assume with your new venue, you're expecting a lot more.
Well, the idea was to make it bigger, better, and bikier this year. So, yes, I'm expecting twice that amount. And, you know, I'm hoping that that happens because it's supposed to be a beautiful weekend. And we have a sponsor by the name of Grolsch, who's going to be sampling beer on the back terrace that day. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you're going to have a lot of cyclists because cycling and beer, you know, it's sort of they go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Well, I really wish you a lot of luck with the show. I wish I could come to New York and join you this year. Maybe in 2013 I will.
We'd love to have you.
Oh, well, I'm doing a lot of traveling for the show this year. So New York was not one of my stops, but I'm really, really glad that our mutual friend Jim Keefe put us together because I'm glad to know about the show. And so it's next weekend.
That's correct.
And from 10 to 7 each day, Saturday and Sunday. And
correct.
It's newambikeshow.com.
That's correct.
Oh, awesome. Well, Joanna, good luck next weekend. I'll be watching and seeing how it goes. I'm assuming you're going to get some media coverage.
Oh, lots of it.
Awesome. Well, enjoy. Thank you for taking time for me tonight on the show.
Oh, thank you, Diane.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Joanna Varello joined us from New York City, where she is about to launch the second annual New Amsterdam Bike Show.
She is indeed.
Sounds like a good time.
It does. It's too bad I'm not going to be in NYC this weekend.
Yeah.
Next weekend.
Next weekend.
Yeah,
the
next weekend.
April 28th and 29th would be the dates on that.
Right. Yeah. Boy, those are long hours those days. I'm glad I'm not exhibiting.
True. That would be an especially interesting show to go to because just, you know, sort of the confluence of all the bike culture that happens in New York every day anyway.
Well,
and then you concentrate it in one room.
In one room, 6,000 people? I just can't even imagine.
Yeah.
It must be a big venue if they moved it. It
would be a big cloud of smug hovering over that.
Oh, wait. Is that a new kind of smoke? It's called smug?
You never watched South Park.
You know, I have trouble because I can't understand what the hell they're talking
about.
Well,
I'm sure that it's available online somewhere. You've got to Google South Park and smug.
Okay.
It's a very good episode about people who drive hybrids.
Oh, all right. There's also a good episode about banking and money that cracked me up. I did see that one because we have a friend who's a banker and just cracked him up.
Nothing to do with cycling, but yes, we better get the heck out of here. Well, we will be back next week with another action-packed edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
We will indeed.
Until then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.